Georgia's DBHDD has an urgent health warning. One of every 10 counterfeit pills contain fentanyl, a powerful and very deadly drug. Pills from friends or dealers are unsafe, and one pill can cause an overdose. More info at opioidresponse.info.
It is really hard to believe we're down to the final weekend before November 3rd, the final day in which people can vote in the 2020 general election cycle. I cannot imagine that there is anyone out there, with very few exceptions, who isn't just really eager to get this thing over with. I realize that we're probably not going to have a lot of returns or final returns by the end of the night on November 3rd in some key races. But at least we're winding towards a conclusion. And I sense, and I'll ask the panel actually about this, so much anxiety among people out there just waiting to see how this election will turn out. No matter whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, the stakes are so incredibly high. Just a quick program note. We will, as I've mentioned on the show before, the Political Rewind team will be doing election coverage on Tuesday night starting at 7 p.m. NPR will bring you national news about the election, and we'll cut into that several times each hour. And at 10 o'clock, we're going to do a special election night edition of Political Rewind. Jim Galloway, one of the people who will be joining us for that, and we hope by that time to have some returns that we can talk about in a pretty substantive way. Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger insists that he believes that because of the way counties, offices are able to initially process mail-in votes, and yes, absentee votes, he thinks the count will go quicker here than many people expect, so we'll watch. The other quick program note is that on Tuesday and Wednesday, on Election Day and the day after, we will do a live show at 9, as we always do. But rather than a tape show, a rerun at 2, we're going to do live shows on Tuesday and Wednesday because we want to make sure that we're completely up to speed on all of the developments that are happening throughout Election Day and the next day as votes continue to be counted. All right, with all that in mind, let's get right to the panel. Jim Galloway is here with us. You know him. He's the lead political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, oversees the Political Insider blog at AJC.com. And Jim, am I right? The anxiety level is just sky high. People want this over with.
Anxiety, yes. Lead story in the Wall Street Journal is that it has removed firearms from their display cases in their stores across the
Walmart.
Country. Walmart. You can still buy a gun if you ask for one, but you're not going to be able to see them. And they cite incidents of civil unrest and fears of such.
Hey. Thanks, Jim. That really ratcheted up the tension.
Good morning.
We're also joined today by political science professor Karen Owen, who you know teaches at the University of West Georgia. Karen, thank you for being with us. It's great to have you here. What about you? Are you doing a check on your anxiety?
So, yes, I was going to say you just added, Jim, to more tension and anxiety that I have with that news. And I would say, too, that I'm ready to talk to the students about different topics in American government other than just the election. So I'm ready for some end results and moving on.
I get that. We're also joined by Sam Olens, former Attorney General of the state of Georgia, and before that, the chairman of the Cobb County Commission, now a partner with Dentons, the world's largest law firm. Sam, how are you holding up as the election? I mean, you have certainly lived as a candidate through many election cycles yourself. You're not a candidate this time out, but it's got to be hitting you in some way emotionally, too, I'll bet.
Well, first of all, good morning. Candidly, I don't have anxiety. I just want to wake up about a week from now, hopefully know the winner, and let other issues take the oxygen in the room rather than this election.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. Michael Thurman is also with us again today, the CEO of DeKalb County, longtime public servant, I think is the best way to describe that. He was state labor commissioner, legislator from Athens early in his political career, candidate for U.S. Senate, Democrat in 2010. Michael, you are unopposed in your election next week. Nevertheless, you're on the ballot.
Yes, yes, and a little bit nervous about that. You know, none of the above could overtake me. But you know, to the but you know, looking forward to a second term. But you know, it's not so much anxiety in my, you know, as it relates to me. Because either way, no matter who wins the president, the presidential race, we'll have a job to do and people to serve, and we'll have to go about that business regardless. And so that's how I'm looking at it.
Michael,
I'm a little. Go ahead, Bill.
Go. No. You finish, please.
No, I'm finished. I'm finished. So that's it. I got a job to do regardless.
Okay, I do want to ask you two quick questions about the county. Number one, how are you all doing there with storm cleanup? I know you said you're without power yourself, and that today you're sitting in your car doing the show by cell phone. So thank you very much under difficult circumstances for doing that. But how is the county in general at this point? Are all of your polling places open? Do they have power today?
Well, we have to check. I've not had a chance to check with the Board of Elections to see how much power was restored overnight. We had nearly 100 streets and roads impacted by fallen trees, a large percentage of the county without power, including here in Smoke Rise in my neighborhood. So it had a tremendous impact. You know, we are a county that's blessed with an abundance of trees and forests, but anytime there's wind or high or rain, we pay a price. So consequently, we're soldiering on, though, and hopefully Georgia Power will get us back online soon.
All right. Well, good luck to you. I know, Jim Galloway, you're without power as well up there, or you don't have internet at the very least in Cobb County. So, Jim, let me ask you about some latest in early voting. The Secretary of State's office is now reporting that more than 3.6 million ballots have been cast in this state. And today, of course, is the final day of early voting. We expect there are going to be long lines of people at the polling places today. 2.4 million have voted in person. 1.1 million have sent in their ballots and had them processed. They've been accepted, not counted yet. And there's still 344,000 mail-in ballots that are outstanding. So, Jim, there's no question we're going to see, by the time we get through November 3rd, by far the biggest number of voters we've ever seen in the state, yes?
Right. Raffensperger is now saying that we could have 6 million votes cast in Georgia. That's 2 million more than were cast in 2016. And it would, I'm not all that great at math right now, but that would bring turnout close to 80%, which if you'll remember a few shows back, Audrey Haynes says we haven't reached since 1908.
That's astonishing. Sam Olens, you sent an article on to, I think everybody who's on the show today got it. I certainly did. And I want to ask you about it just for a moment, because it relates to the early vote, especially mail-in ballots. But just to put it in a larger perspective, nationally, if you look at the U.S. Voter Project's numbers on early voting, 82 million Americans have already voted early. 28 million of them have voted in person, but 53 million have been voting by mail. It's a reverse of Georgia. Georgia's had more in-person than mail-in ballots. But you sent on to us an article from an interview with a Georgia State professor talking about the future is in mail-in ballots and what the impact can be if that's the case. Yes? Talk about why that article struck you.
Well, I mean, you know, clearly there's places on the West Coast, like Oregon, that have been doing mail-in exclusive voting for years. It has gone smoothly. There haven't been any issues, increased fraud, et cetera. And in many ways, it changes the whole dynamic because, you know, for instance, you wouldn't be watching TV now watching one political disgusting ad after another. You would have already put your ballot in the mail or you won't be counted. The other thing about the article was it showed nationally about a 5 to 10% increase in overall voting by making it accessible for mail-in. As you noted, it's interesting, in our state, about a third of the votes so far have been by mail, two-thirds still in person. Clearly, that number is going to go higher, so it may go more to that 20 to 25% range. But, I mean, frankly, I'm in that category. My wife and I voted weeks ago. It's just easier. I mean, I had no interest in standing in a line for a long time, irrespective of COVID, but COVID makes it worse. So I think from my perspective, it doesn't matter which party you are, the greater the turnout, the greater the democracy works. So as Jim stated, if we're looking at an 80% turnout, that's fantastic.
Yeah, yeah. Sean Ritchie is the professor who has studied the mail-in voting. He points out that in 2024, California will do all of its voting by mail, and that we expect that at the same time, 20% of the population are going to live in states that do entirely vote by mail. And just for another minute on this subject, Karen, it strikes me that as the election, if the election unfolds well, if we don't have any tremendous problems, with a Donald Trump not having to worry about either re-election to a third term if he wins re-election, but with him out of the way in that sense, maybe there won't be this attack on mail-in voting, and it will start to become a much more broadly accepted way to vote by both parties.
I think that's a correct statement. You will hear probably more conversations because it does allow for accessibility and the convenience for people to vote, particularly those who are young and working. They can get those ballots ahead of time, fill them out, and turn them in. It will change, though, the conversation the parties have about campaigning. And that's, I think, what Sam was alluding to, is that people will be casting ballots perhaps a month out, and so they won't be turning in, and flyers and advertisements the week before kind of election day won't have the same impact that they once had.
Okay, Michael, let me turn you now back to the fact that we're 3 days before voting really gets underway on Election Day here in Georgia, when polls open at 7 o'clock. We've been trying to read the tea leaves on these early votes and where they're coming from and whether it is Democrats who are voting early, Republicans. And yesterday, David Ralston, the Speaker, was on the show, and he pointed out that the reality is that early votes are coming in big numbers from red counties in the state, too, that we shouldn't presume that this large turnout is turning out for Democratic candidates. What's your take on that, Michael?
I think he's absolutely right. If you look at the numbers, there's been a significant turnout in the northern outer suburbs and outer burbs of Georgia. And you're seeing a major turnout in red counties as well as blue. One of the things that I'm concerned about, and I've been trying to drill down to understand, is who is actually voting early. If these are high propensity voters who are voting early, that may or may not result in a greater turnout. It's just that people who were going to vote are just exercising their franchise at an earlier point in the process. The key is to look at new voters and whether or not they are coming in and actually casting a ballot. And ultimately, that, I think, will determine who actually succeeds on Election Day. It's not just that people, because you got the corona effect. It's why people rush to food markets at the beginning of the virus. people who are suffering high anxiety tend not to want to wait, even to be able to wait, because of fear they may not be able to either purchase the bread, and in this case, actually cast the vote because of the pandemic.
Jim, you reported on that in The Jolt just yesterday, the fact that you're seeing turnout in red areas of the state as well as blue, and we shouldn't take anything for granted in terms of the conventional wisdom that it's Democrats who turn out early.
Well, yes, you're seeing in places like Dawson County, up in North Georgia, you are seeing, if you go to GeorgiaVotes.com, you'll see that quite a few counties are well above the 100% mark over the 2016 balloting. But I'm taking a look at House districts. You spoke about Speaker Ralston and one of the kind of and yesterday's show drilled down on how one of the more important races is for control of the state House. But if you I'm looking right now looking at House District 50. It's occupied by Angelica Kausha in North Fulton, and it's up at 135%. Of the 2016 vote, and right next to her, very close by, is House District 47, which is occupied by Jan Jones, the Speaker Pro Tem and the highest ranking woman in the House. She's a Republican, and her voters are already at 119%. Over. So, yeah, you see a lot of rural counties at about the 100% mark, but the super layer, I think, is in suburban Atlanta.
I think it's right. We did spend a good amount of time on yesterday's show talking about legislative races. David Ralston has been on a tour of the state out there stumping for Republicans. Karen, it is really interesting, and Galloway made the point in his writing yesterday, we do tend to talk about the big races, the presidential race, the U.S. Senate races, congressional races, and we forget sometimes about just how important these legislative races are. Democrats need to pick up 16 seats to win control of the state House, and this becomes even more crucial this year than ever because we're in the end of a census period and reapportionment will get underway in the next year. So talk a little bit about how you see the battle for the House shaping up and the impact, what it means.
So you're absolutely correct. So we do talk a lot about the national races or those that send to the federal office, but these state House races and state Senate races have a significant impact on the state. And you're right, redistricting will come up next year, and if the Democrats are able to flip the state House, then that makes redistricting even much more of a compromise because you have to work within the Democrats and then a Republican governor. And interesting, you know, Jim's article where he focused in on the state House races, he identified 21 races, I believe that's the correct number, what he was kind of watching, and 14 of those races involve a woman matched up against another woman. And so if we actually look at the General Assembly right now, the Democratic Party in the state of Georgia is half of the membership of that caucus is women. And so some of these flips will come if some women can actually flip some of these Republican districts. And I think we kind of need to pay attention to that because that will also shape the dynamics of governing if the Democrats control the House in Georgia for 2021-2022.
Sam, one of the concerns, of course, for Democrats is if they come close, if they don't pick up 16, but if they pick up, say, 10, when redistricting happens with Republicans in control of drawing the lines completely, the gains that Democrats may have made in sheer numbers can be really, really reversed by maps that disfavors them for reelection, yes?
No, absolutely. Just, you know, I presume the Republicans would do what works best for them, just as Democrats have historically done the same in Georgia and throughout the country. I expect that the Democrats will gain some seats. I don't think it will be close to 10, I don't think the House majority is in danger of flipping this time, nor is the Senate in danger of flipping. I think the real test in many ways will be 2 years from now when we have a governor's election on the top of the ticket. Clearly, everyone's going to be looking at those votes election night, in particular the women Republican incumbents, you know, whether it's a Jan Jones, a Sharon Cooper, a Kay Kilpatrick. All of those seats are going to be looked at closely. But, you know, candidly, there's some seats near Jan's elsewhere in North Georgia, in North Fulton that are going to be looked at closely. John Albers, for one, I mean, it was closer last time than people expected. So I think everyone's going to be looking around the whole metro area. I think one of the things that will be very interesting is if Georgia is an outlier as compared to the nation with regard to suburban women. The early polling seems to show that Georgia is an outlier and that the Republicans are keeping a greater percentage of that female vote than maybe elsewhere in our country. So, you know, from an academician's perspective, this is going to be fascinating.
Bill, can I?
Michael, weigh in.
Well, the Democrats, when you really think about it, writ large, of course, the goal is to win the majority. But even if, as Sam stated, they pick up 10 seats, with the speaker facing opposition, and Jim is going to love this when he gets under the Gold Dome in January, the Democrats may determine who the speaker is between the two Republican contestants, because they'll be in a position to decide whether Speaker Ralston returns or whether his challenger defeats him, even if they don't earn a majority of the seats.
Michael makes a great point. The speaker's election does become much more interesting if Democrats don't take majority control.
Yeah, I've got a line in the Sunday column that says close only counts in horseshoes, hand grenades, and legislative power grabs. here's a couple of things. Number one, since 2000, we've had control of 15 chambers in state government end up in ties. I think in 2011 it was the Virginia Senate, 2002 it was the North Carolina House, and in those cases you always have to kind of develop a power sharing agreement, and so to Karen's point, yeah, you could see the ascendancy of some Democratic policies that come with that, which would be extremely interesting, I think.
We're going to watch the legislative races very closely. I thought one thing, Jim, it's interesting, is we know that Republicans are really targeting the minority leader in the House, Bob Hamill. He's under heavy pressure, and they've dumped $1 million into getting him out of the legislature. Mary Margaret Oliver on the show last week said, "What the heck can you do with $1 million in one legislative race in middle Georgia?" It seems a little excessive, but it does make the point. They're really after him, especially Jim.
I talked to Mr. Trammell a couple days ago and asked him about this, and the apparent intent of all this spending was to keep the leader of the Democratic caucus kind of pinned down in his own district, so that he couldn't organize the Democratic response. But he reminded me that we are in a pandemic. And all organizing now is done by Zoom, of course. So the idea of keeping him physically in one place is kind of outdated. However, he is in Luthersville in rural Georgia, and their internet situation is pretty bad. He says he can't direct the Democratic caucus from home. He has to go to his office, which is about a mile away.
Okay, let's do this. We'll leave Bob Trammell and the Republicans to fight it out in Luthersville. Take a quick break and be back with more on Political Rewind.
Thanks for listening to Political Rewind. If you like this show, you'll also like Georgia Today. It's a daily podcast from GPB News, bringing you compelling stories and in-depth reporting that you won't hear anywhere else. Join me, Peter Biello, for this quick and convenient way to get the best of GPB News' extensive coverage of the topics that matter to you, delivered directly to your device every weekday afternoon.
Dr. Karen Owen of the University of West Georgia, Michael Thurman, CEO of DeKalb County, Sam Olens, former Attorney General of the state of Georgia, Jim Galloway, on this final Friday before Election Day here on Political Rewind. By the way, I don't say it enough, but when I mentioned this on Monday, we suddenly got some good traffic, so let me do it again. You can follow us on Twitter at PoliticsGPB, and I hope you do. We always like the interaction that we get with people who respond to what we're talking about. Or, you know, I'd also love to have you follow me personally. My handle is Nigut, N-I-G-U-T-B, Nigut B. So we'd love to have you following us on Twitter. Let's move on. Sam, because you are the Republican on the panel today, let me ask you about Larry Sabatow's crystal ball. We've talked about Sabatow a number of times on the show. He is considered one of the more reputable, one of the smarter political prognosticators. And he has now moved both Senate races, which had started out as likely Republican, leans Republican. They moved progressively in the opposite direction. And now on the verge of Election Day itself, Sabatow has both Senate races as toss-ups. Do you think that's correct? And how is that happening?
So my guess is that he may very well be correct. I think there's an outside chance that Senator Perdue will win without a runoff, but I think the runoff certainly is likely due to the barrage of TV ads. That's clearly got to be one of the most negative overall races in the country. It makes no difference what time you're watching on TV. The ads against the two candidates, forget the Libertarian, are just outrageous. I think the AJC or maybe Jim in particular referenced there were going to be over $200 million in TV ads for this election. So it would not surprise me. The interesting issue for political, what would be the appropriate term, people that have it in their blood and can't get rid of it. So Kelly Loeffler would still be senator on January 3. David Perdue would not be on January 3 if they both have runoffs. You'd have a period until the state certified the election results for the Perdue-Ossoff race to be certified and sworn in. So that's one of the interesting things with the beginning of the next congressional session. I still continue to think that Senator Perdue will eke it out. But it would be no surprise at all if they both have runoffs.
Michael, we've seen Perdue and Ossoff in two debates in this cycle, one by the Atlanta Press Club a couple weeks ago, and then just this week, a debate in Savannah. And I have to say, Michael, Ossoff gave as good as he got in both of those debates and showed a confidence that I thought was really fascinating. He is basically, I mean, he ran that special election against Karen Handel, But he seemed very confident in the way he went after David Perdue. It's going to be interesting to see how that race unfolds. What are you thinking there, Michael? And do you imagine, Sam says he thinks maybe David Perdue can eke out a victory without a runoff. Shane Hazel's at 2% right now. Do you think it's possible Ossoff could do that?
Well, absolutely. What we're really witnessing is the maturation of a young political leader slash candidate in John Ossoff. He's much more mature and confident, as you just stated, and more convicted in terms of his positions. And so that's what happens with politicians, just like athletes and anyone else. Over time, you become more experienced and more confident and more clear-eyed in terms of what your principles and your beliefs are. And absolutely, he could win it. It's going to be about not just the base turnout, but also how well he can penetrate with moderate and conservative voters. I happen to believe that if you look at the early turnout statistics and what you're going to see among the base, particularly African-American voters, is a turnout similar to 2016, not 2008, but 2016. What's going to be different, and what is different in Georgia, and you talked about Bob Trammell and rural Georgia, is more white voters embracing Joe Biden, and that's going to impact all the way down the ticket and ultimately may result in a different outcome.
Yeah, I want to talk in just a minute about the new Monmouth poll, which in fact talks about where they think white voters are headed in this election. We'll do that in just a minute. But before we do, Karen, your take on the Ossoff Perdue race.
So I think one of the key factors is the amount of money we are seeing poured in, not only from the candidate standpoint, but from national outside organizations that want to have an impact. And so if we look at the race, it is really tight. I am amazed that I've seen so much discussion of name-calling and negativity between the two candidates. And then when you do see the candidates together, they seem very frustrated, exasperated at one another, really kind of going after one another, which is just a new set here in politics. One point, though, I am watching, and Mike, you mentioned this about voters in the state turning out, you know, the base gets turned out, but how willing will some white voters be to select Biden at the top of the ticket, but then put a check in the Senate and then maybe go ahead and go back to Perdue so that there is a little bit of divided government? We do know voters have been sometimes savvy with that so that they keep the checks and the accountability at the federal level. It's a possibility, but likelihood that these are runoffs are great. Yes, I would say so.
Jim, just the fact that we're talking about two Senate races where Democrats might have the potential to win in these final hours, the fact that Donald Trump, who we'll talk about this a little in a minute, is coming back to Georgia on Sunday evening, it tells you everything you need to know about the wave that is finally hitting the state. Whether it, which has been talked about for years, whether this is the year that it happens is certainly not clear at this moment. But there's no question that if you're a Republican in this state and you think beyond 2020, you've got to figure out what the heck you do to stop the Democratic advances that are coming at them.
Yeah, I think Sam's earlier point that really the true test is 2022. I think that's right. But I mean, you could see a blue wave that gets up to Republican knees and maybe their chest. I don't know if it's going to get up to their ears. But I would point out that you've got, of course, Trump's visit here on Sunday in Rome, in just a highly, highly Republican place, really says a lot about where his campaign is, where Republicans are in Georgia. But as we've mentioned in previous shows, you know, it's the fact that David Perdue in these polls that we're seeing is not polling ahead of Donald Trump, that should be ringing all sorts of alarm bells for Republicans, because your fortunes are tied directly to the White House.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was going to make this point when we talked, Jim, about the legislative races. Everybody's fortunes are tied to the White House right now, all the way down the ticket. I mean, even you cannot remove Donald Trump even from a state House race in some far corner of the state of Georgia. It's all nationalized, Jim.
Absolutely. And, you know, and look, the Democrats are praying for, to Karen's point earlier, Democrats are praying for just a deluge of straight ticket voters who don't wander away after voting for Biden and keep going straight down the Democratic ticket. When I talked to David Ralston earlier this week, he said that was, he conceded that was the key, that they have to persuade a great number of people who don't like Donald Trump that Republicans still represent their values in the state house. And so he wants them to switch back to the Republican side after they vote against Trump.
All right, let's talk just a bit about the presidential race in Georgia. Karen, let me start with you. The fact that Trump is coming back here tells us that the state really is in play, that he can't ignore Georgia even in the last couple of days. He should be able to skip Georgia altogether, as most presidential candidates have done for any number of campaigns in the last 2 decades here. Last time a Democrat won the state, 1992, when Bill Clinton did, and then Clinton couldn't even win it again in his reelection campaign in 96. So Trump should be able to put a checklist next to Georgia and go back to Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan. He can't afford to do it, Karen. And if the Monmouth University poll is any indication, he has good reason to be a little nervous. Monmouth shows Biden now for the first time with an outside the margin of error lead over President Trump in Georgia. Galloway, am I wrong? Is it not outside the 50-45 is one of the numbers they give us?
But it's an MOE of about 4%, so it's not quite. It's not quite outside.
Okay, thank you for that. Nevertheless, they show him in one calculation as having a 4 to 5 point lead over Trump in the election. And this poll is from beginning of the week. Karen?
Yes. And I was going to say, this poll, I would give a little bit of caution to, as it is asking registered voters. It hasn't looked at likely voters, but it does have Biden up. I think the president is back in Georgia, which, you know, he should have been able. He didn't come in 2016, but he's having to come now because it is not a sure fight here in Georgia. Interesting in this poll, and I would, I would caution, is that further down in the cross tabs, you will see that of the 504 registered voters asked the question about how much they've been contacted by a political campaign, and almost 30% said that they had not been contacted by any political campaign or any type of pollster or other than this, but other, you know, types of political participation, which says to me that those were not high salient likely voters anyway, because the campaigns aren't reaching them. I think that's kind of interesting to look at here, because who knows if the propensity for those people to turn out to vote is there. But you're right. At the beginning of this, you asked about, you know, Trump coming back. Trump's coming back because he really needs to make sure that voters turn out. And turnout is the biggest thing right now for Georgia.
Michael, the interesting thing about this poll is that it gives Biden 31%. Of the white vote in Georgia. That's a higher percentage of white vote for a Democrat than we've seen in any of the other polling that's been done in the state, despite the fact the other polls show it as basically a tie going forward. It also, I think, shows that Trump picks up double digits in terms of African-American men, something like 11 points. How do you weigh all that out, Michael?
Well, following up on what Professor Owen said, think about it. Trump is doing slightly better with African Americans. President Trump is doing better with Hispanic and Latinos. But most polls now still have Biden either even or slightly ahead. That's because of something I've been seeing from day one. White voters in Georgia and really across this nation will determine who the next president of the United States will be. What Joe Biden has done a brilliant tactical shift. What Democrats, I think we need to listen and see and learn from it. You can't really just run a campaign based on demographic shifts, growth of people of color in the population or in the voting population. Obviously, you turn out your base. But what Biden has done is that's why he was in Warm Springs this week, or was it last week? I can't keep up. This week, he's reaching out and basically reconfiguring the Democratic coalition, where it looks more like it looked post Civil Rights Act in 1965 than it looked post 2010. What is happening is he is appealing not just to college-educated whites. He's also appealing to non-college-educated working people, and particularly whites who've been either impacted directly or indirectly by the coronavirus. This virus will change everything about this nation. It's going to reconfigure political coalitions. It's going to change, as Sam talked about earlier, how we vote. And it's going to change. It's like 9/11, and compare how we used to get on a plane and fly to any destination and how 9/11 changed it. Coronavirus is fundamentally changing America politically and otherwise. And Biden has strategically, I call it the Corona Coalition. He's forming a Corona Coalition, Republican, Democrats, white, black, Latinos, people who either directly or indirectly who've been impacted either through health or economics by the coronavirus.
Sam, weigh in on this.
So, you know, it's interesting. I was just thinking yesterday that I think the election is unclear today as it was 4 years ago. I certainly agree with Mike's comments about the white African-American and Hispanic votes. But I think at the end of the day, there are a lot of Trump voters that will not acknowledge it until they're within the confines of the voting machine. And when you look at how, in general, in those critical states for both parties, those swing states, they're now pretty much all within the margin of error. I don't think we'll frankly know who the next president is until maybe the end of next week. I mean, I candidly think in states like Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, we're not going to know because there's that shift that just doesn't show up in polls. People don't want to admit in some cases that they're going to vote for the president. So it's actually very interesting to me. As much as everyone wanted to view 2020 differently because Donald Trump is now the incumbent as compared to an open presidential race, I'm beginning to think it's more and more like 2016.
So, Jim, we got to take a break, but let me give you the last word on this. Building on what Sam just said, and again, saying that Democrats for quite some time have had great hopes about finally flipping Georgia, what we see over and over again is promising data for Democrats, and then at the last minute, Republicans come home, get out there, cast their ballots, and win elections. So Sam sees 2016 as the example of that, but 2020 could be the beginning of a new era.
Yeah, well, I kind of like Michael's phrasing about the coronavirus alliance that Biden put together. But I will also say Sam does have a point, especially when it comes to just the national view. You've got some Democratic worries developing up in Michigan and up in Wisconsin surrounding, I think it was Wisconsin and not Minnesota, surrounding the Senate races there. Republicans say that there's a path for them to retain control of the Senate by flipping the Michigan seat and the other seat. And that kind of gets to Sam's point about us not knowing precisely and exactly where these little pockets of the electorate are going.
And it's going to make election night all the more interesting. So let's do this. Let's get our final break of the show out of the way and come back with time to do just a little more on today's Political Rewind. Back on Political Rewind, Jim Galloway, just a quick note about the other Senate race number two. The polling continues to show that Raphael Warnock is growing, the leading Democrat in that contest, in people wanting to vote for him, whereas Kelly Loeffler and Doug Collins continue to duke it out between them. And that dynamic will lead to a runoff. And it's going to be, Jim, how do you evaluate at this point, this back and forth between Loeffler and Collins? You'd be crazy to try to make a guess as to which of them is going to win the Republican, what is essentially a Republican primary.
Well, I would say what this does is it pits $23 million, which is what she's poured into her own race, and support from the governor against a network of state House members led by David Ralston, who most of whom are backing Doug Collins. So it's an interesting dynamic here that's going to have repercussions no matter who wins. My question is, the last time this happened was the Sam Nunn race, Sam Nunn David Gambrell in 72, and Democrats at that time were able to really quickly reunite so that they could keep the Republican Fletcher Thompson from taking that Senate seat. And the question now is this race has gotten so bitter. I'm just wondering if Republicans will be able to reunite in time for a January 5 runoff when Raphael Warnock, backed by just huge amounts of national money, is going to be kind of the front runner.
Sam, we've talked on the show a number of times about the fact that Raphael Warnock, while Loeffler and Collins are attacking each other, has been left in the clear to run every positive spot that he has. And there are a lot of people who have been letting me know how much they like his commercials at this point, because they're positive, they're uplifting. But Republicans are going to have between November 3rd and January 5th, a long time to bring out the big guns that they've been gathering in terms of things that they'll say Warnock supported as a pastor, sermons he gave. I mean, there's plenty of time for that. This isn't a 3-week runoff as we used to see in the state, right, Sam?
Yeah, we now have a 9-week runoff in large part based on, I think it's Muvaca or something like that, a federal statute that's been around for a long time to frankly help our military to assure that they have the right to vote. 9 weeks is a lifetime. So while I agree with Jim that there's going to be a lot of heartburn, there's plenty of time for the ice to melt and for a united attack. There's also time, if the president were to win, to promptly tell Doug, if he comes in third, that he has a job in the next administration, which would help that discussion. And as Jim stated at the end, let's face it, while I personally like Reverend Warnock, and I think he is an outstanding preacher and an outstanding Georgian, I think it's fair to say that he's more liberal than the overall state. So there are plenty of policy discussions for them to have in that 9-week period. And at the moment, as you stated, there is no such discussion because he's skating with no opposition until the runoff.
Hey, Michael, you were talking about the coalition that you think Biden is building in a very smart way that relies on more white voters. And you say Biden will win if he wins because of white voters. Raphael Warnock is not polling well among white voters right now. I don't know, is that a function of the fact that right now, given a choice between two Republicans and the Democrat, they naturally tend to be more likely to vote for a Republican? Can he win some of them over to his side? What's your take on that?
He's a very smart person and has shown unique political skills. He'll have time to hopefully build what would look like a general election campaign. As was stated earlier, really, basically, he's in a Democratic primary as well as the Republicans. And in primaries, you run either left or right. And so you've seen the Republicans run to the right. I like Jim's analysis of the 23 million plus the House versus House network. I think Doug Collins has the advantage in that particular scenario. Having been a member of the House, it reminds me of Murphy. And with Speaker Ralston, those networks are phenomenal. When I was running statewide, I can't tell you how valuable it was. Now, they were Democrats then. If you can go to Swainsboro and sit in Butch Parrish's drugstore on a Saturday afternoon, Jack Hill, the late Jack Hill, I used to go to his grocery store down in Reedsville and spend an entire Saturday. That's what that network would do for you, particularly in rural Georgia, which is how and why I think at the end of the day, Doug Collins will win what's in effect the Republican primary.
Oh, Karen, when Michael Thurman conjures up the image of Thomas B. Murphy, the former Democratic Speaker of the House, I'm sure that gives you a little thrill.
It did, as I direct his center at the University of West Georgia. Absolutely. And it does bring up absolutely every point of how Speaker Murphy used to get his network out. And when he got his weight behind a candidate, that candidate typically won. And I think that there is an advantage Collins has right now. I think the interesting piece of this runoff will be how many voters come back to vote. Republicans typically have that advantage to turn out their voters back in a runoff. And I've seen some polls recently asking likely voters and registered voters about this race. And it's, you know, 7-8% are saying they just won't vote again. And so the messaging has to come back that you need to turn back out.
So as we come to the end of today's show, what's striking, Jim, is with the final day of voting, which is what I've now realized we've got to refer to it as next Tuesday, November 3rd, approaches. So many races in this state are up for grabs in a way we haven't seen for many, many years. Jim, it's going to be a very exciting week next week.
Right. And I would just, you know, urge everybody just to have a little patience. I think these races, these down ticket races that we've been talking about, they're not going to be decided on that on Tuesday night either. We're going to be seeing a whole lot of counting going on into Wednesday and Thursday. So just kind of just take a deep breath think of Doris Day, que sera, sera.
Right. Jim Galloway gets the last word. You'll be back with me on Monday's show. Karen Owen, Sam Olens, Michael Thurman, thank you all so much for a great conversation today. I appreciate your being here. Y'all have a wonderful election day next week. We'll be back on Monday. I'm Bill Nigut. Until I see you again, take care. Stay healthy. Wear a mask. Get a flu shot. See y'all next week.